Eventually Super Train, episode 166. I'm your main host, Dan. Hello, everyone. How are you? Welcome to the show. We are a short-lived TV show podcast. Covers the short-lived TV shows that never got enough love. Eventually, we will cover Super Train. We go three shows at a time, and in this one, you're lucky because we're starting off a brand new old show. This episode begins with a great Stan Peele and myself discussing the fourth episode as broadcast of Partners in Crime, the Linda Carter, Lonnie Anderson detective series. You will find out in a few moments why I keep saying the fourth episode as broadcast. And then the great Tim S. Turner and myself are discussing season 2, episode 3, basically episode 9 of Max Headroom, Grossberg's Return. And then, for the final segment of this episode, well, I'm not going to tell you who's back, but someone we like is back, and we will be discussing a brand new old show, the first episode of it. In fact, the pilot, as it were. And so I would like to play you a little bit of the Partisan Crime theme. I'm going to give you a little plot breakdown, and Stan and I are going to talk all about it.
Carol,
that's Linda.
Is brunette and tall.
Sydney,
that's Lonnie.
Is streetwise and small. And together they solve crimes while he is super hot.
Oh, yeah.
They call the cops a lot. They got here just in time. They're friends of mine.
These ladies are partners in crime.
All right, this episode of Partners in Crime is The Pilot, the first episode made. It's a two-hour episode written by James Stark, directed by Harry Falk, and Leonard Stern. This is really the only time Leonard Stern, who co-created the show, his name comes up anywhere here. October 13th, 1984, it was the fourth episode that aired. In this one, Carol Stanwyck, Sidney Kovac, who were once married to this detective guy whose name I forget, doesn't really matter, who owns a big sort of lovely house in Pacific Heights, San Francisco, and he is killed while investigating a case, murdered in his office. And the two ladies, Carol and Sidney, who are very different. We talked all about them already. You know the characters already. This is the episode where they learn that they have inherited the detective agency from their ex-husband and get involved in the case that he was murdered over, for, around. Would you like to hear Stan and me talk about this? I think you would. Check this out. The Pilot of Partisan Crime, the fourth episode broadcast of the series. It's a two-hour episode, unlike the hour-long previous ones. And I'm here with the great Stan Peele. Stan, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing okay. I mentioned in the previous episode that Stan likes to eat during the podcast. So if you can guess what Stan is eating, and he might give you clues, then you win an evening with Stan.
Yay!
So we're going to dive right in. While he's got a mouthful of food, what did you think of the pilot?
Well, I enjoyed it for what it is. It's,
I'm going to have a mouthful of food now after that one.
I mean, I will be honest with you. When we talked about watching these, I started with the pilot, even though it's listed as episode 4, because I just thought that was the logical place to go. I enjoyed it more that time than I did rewatching it for this podcast, because I've seen the last episode where their chemistry was good, they've settled into their parts, and right here is, you know, in the pilot, they're new to this, the writers are new, there's a lot about the episode that I think they weren't sure they were going to keep.
Yes.
You know, there's things that definitely changed. The mother-in-law was a more prominent character, I think, in the pilot than she wound up being. There's an extra character who doesn't show up in the series after this, and he's clearly intended to be part of the ensemble cast.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of weirdness to it and a little bit of awkwardness to it. Mm-hmm. However, I think Lonnie and Linda sort of prove their worth. Like I think they, you know, there's you're seeing the reason that they were, I don't know if they were selected for this or if one of them engineered it and got the other one on board. I don't know how it got put together exactly, but But for whatever reason, I think these two carry the show. I think, you know, they don't carry it as evenly and confidently as they would maybe 5 episodes down the line, because they're still trying to find their way. But it's interesting enough. They look, of course, beautiful and glamorous. They both have their talents. You know, they're both good actors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lonnie, as we've talked about previously, has great comic timing. I don't think she's given the lines that will help her along in this episode as much as later on. So anyway, it's uneven, but it's enjoyable enough. It definitely doesn't have to be a 2-hour episode.
Yeah, that was kind of my main issue.
It seems to go on for a long time.
Yes. Okay, so Stan's going to have a little something to eat. And feel free to listen to me and listen to the sounds beneath my speaking.
Okay.
But I'm kind of with you there. It's interesting. Like, in all honesty, we probably should have started with this because it makes sense. But because it was not broadcast that way, I thought it would be more interesting to watch it the way people actually saw it. Mm-hmm. And I could actually see, like, if this was the first episode, I may have come away from it thinking, I'm not sure I want to come back next week. I like Lonnie and Linda enough, but the sort of mystery was, frankly, kind of dull. And the thing with the bridge, if I have to hear the bridge, where's the bridge? Oh my God. I feel like I'm in Led Zeppelin, The Crunch. Where's the bridge? I can't find the bridge. You're right. It's an hour long episode that is. I almost wish they had shown it in two parts, because then I think if we had separated it, yeah, I could handle it more. But by the time I got about an hour in, I'll be honest, I kept looking at the time. And then when we get to a point at the end where they kind of they sort of catch the guy who steals the bridge, and he's sitting at his desk. And he looks exhausted. And is it John Beck? I think is the actor.
Yeah,
I want to say that's his name. You'll know him when you see him. He's got a great mustache. He was Victoria Principal's Pamela's love interest during the Dream season of Dallas. He's a great looking guy. Very, very sort of Tom Selleck adjacent.
Right.
Kind of look to him. And they catch him with this bridge in the end. And he's just sitting at his desk, and he looks exhausted, and he says something like, it's something like, do to me what you want. I can't take it anymore. And I had the exact same thought, because I thought there's 15 minutes left. And there are things I like in it. I think the Linda and Lonnie are a lot of fun to watch as always. But as you said, there's a lot of time spent on the character of the ex-husband, which they seem to jettison most of when the actual show went to series, because I don't remember hearing much about the ex-husband at all in the three previous episodes. And it's all too much, and it does what they did in the previous episode with Linda's friend. Oh, she was Miss Everything in the World. She was the best. She works all the time. She did everything. And we see no sign of that with the character. And this, it's like, he was, what a detective. He caught everyone up in his world, and he did this thing. He actually, pardon my French, seems a bit like an asshole.
Right.
And there's a reason why these two intelligent women left him, because he was a douche. And they keep describing, he was fake. And like the mother-in-law is like, that's my son. You know, he could be a jerk, but he was something. He was a force of nature. No, he just seems like a manipulating jerk to me. And the episode never proved otherwise.
Right. Like this whole thing with the will and how they had to like stage part of it.
That got on my nerves, actually.
Yeah. Like, I don't even get story-wise why that happened.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I mean, I guess we sort of learned about the characters in a way. You know, like, we got to learn more about Lonnie Anderson by like, putting her in that boxing ring, I guess, because it made it clear that she was the girlfriend of a fighter or something. But ultimately, I don't know why that was important. Like, it didn't do anything for the story.
It's weird, everybody, because the sort of the lawyer leads them through these series of locations they have to go to, where they have to kind of like confront their past and stuff, and it doesn't sort of make any sense. And there's one point where Lonnie Anderson, it looks like she's going to punch the lawyer and is going to take off. And the lawyer's like, no, you have to go through this. And I thought, in what world? When does this happen? I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that you see in like old dark house mysteries where like, Helen had, $1 billion. And in order, like staying overnight in a haunted house isn't as annoying or as in-depth as what these people have to go through. And this guy doesn't have anything but a house.
I know. And it's like falling apart on the inside. It looks great, but it's falling apart.
Yes. And I mean, like, when you get to the point where you're like 70 minutes in and like the 10th person asks, where's the bridge? Do you have the bridge? And it's like, and you're still talking about this ex like he was a good guy. He involved you in all this crap, and you're still acting like, oh, he was something, though. No, he wasn't. He was a jerk. He was a jerk. And he failed in his last case, but provided for sort of himself by dragging you into it. And it's such a weird thing to do, because I feel like the writer, who I think I want to say is one of the co-creators, but might not be, maybe just one of the co-producers or something. And actually, oddly enough, the writer of this episode, I looked up his other credits because I didn't recognize. It was like, I haven't written his name down. Jack Trask or something like that. And I looked up his name. This credit and one episode of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd are his only writing credits. And so I thought, was this an actual writer, or is this maybe like a friend of a friend who they brought in? And because, to be honest, in the last episode I discussed that maybe the murder in the museum was written specifically for 12-year-olds. There are points in this script where I think this is the winner of that competition. Because the script, it does that thing like when you're a young writer, you over-explain.
Right.
You don't always understand that sometimes just being very succinct works the best. And I have that. I do that sometimes when I'm talking about shows on my own on here. I will repeat myself, and that's because I don't have anyone to bounce it off of. So if I make a great point, and I have no one to bounce it off of, it's like I've said something like, "Oh my God," Rosebud was the sled, and there's no noise, and so you're like, Rosebud. But was the sled, and you find yourself repeating it because you know, and it's like the same thing with like early writing. It's like you write something down and you're like, okay, let me make sure that everyone knows how important that is. The bridge, right. Over and over again, and so it really is a weird script, because it sets up the show okay, but I really feel like you had Leonard Stern on there. Why didn't he write the script? He's a great writer. Have him write the script. Then I would have loved this. But as it is, I think it could have been easily done as either a 90-minute movie, so been about 20 minutes shorter, or an hour-long episode, and just made it very compact, and maybe not had everything happen. Maybe they meet and get involved in an adventure, and then in the next episode they move into the house or something like that. Like the Beverly Hillbillies. They didn't move into the mansion until the second episode. At the end of the first episode, they're getting chased by the cops around Beverly Hills. Maybe something like that could have happened. But it's just – it's like you said, it's just kind of – there are moments in it I like the moment where they're reading his notebook, and he has like his list of like the Specter of Death list or something like that. And they're reading through the list, you know, like, oh, what's his last case? My case. And they're reading through, and the last name on there is My Wife. And the two of them look at one another suspiciously. You're like, ooh. So it's either one of them or there's something else going on. So I like that moment.
But in that moment also, they agree to burn that page.
Yes. Yeah.
Because like if it's one of us that's implicated, let's just burn this.
Yes. Exactly. And there's it's kind of a. And there are moments when things happen and I can't tell, like Julie Summars, who's an actress I love. She plays like a clumsy a woman who's always knocking things over and stuff. And I can't tell whether like her character is meant to be sort of mentally touched or whether that's comedy. I can't quite tell whether that's happening. And there are a few moments in the episode where things are happening and I thought, why did they do that? And I thought, was that comedy? Because it's one of the tricky things with 1980s American television is the best American television in the 1980s, the best shows are some of the best shows television ever did. But the majority of the shows that were made in the 80s weren't that great. They really were just like, we didn't do comedy that great in the 80s. And like, we didn't do like action that great. I mean, A-Team possibly, but like, we just sort of like in the 80s, we didn't do a lot of stuff great on television. It's sort of like what was happening, like the 50s, 60s, 70s kind of wore off in the 80s, I think. And so you see a lot of stuff in this where I think, like, Moonlighting is a great example where you watch it and you go, okay, that's comedy, that's funny. But you watch this and there were a few scenes where I thought, are they doing shtick? Or is that, what are they doing there? Because it's not funny, but I think it's meant to be comedy. And I don't mean to denigrate anyone. I just think that's kind of what happened in shows at this time. You would watch a show like, I want to say Simon and Simon had was supposed to have comedy in it.
Mm-hmm. So,
but I never remember laughing at Simon and Simon. And it was one of those things where it was like, it's comedy adjacent. You know, it's a humorous sort of, and that's the way this kind of is. There, some of the other episodes have humorous moments in them. But this one was kind of a little off to me. It just felt off.
Yeah, it seems like Lonnie Anderson, who's you know, showing her comic chops in like the last one, you know, like when they really get going. I don't think she's allowed to. She's not allowed by the script to really sort of comment on, like, if she were allowed to, you know, crack wise or, you know, make commentary on what's going on when it's ridiculous, I think you would see the comedy that's happening. But you don't really get that because they're still trying to figure out who her character is.
Yes.
Like the whole beginning where they introduce her as a character and she's looking at herself in the mirror, she's all glamorous, and then she kind of squats and spreads her legs and they say, and she's a bass player. And then they go to her playing in this band and she's like, she's got these really long nails, but she's playing this bass like it's, you know. And I'm like, who is she supposed to be? You know, and like Linda's supposed to be poor, but she always looks glamorous. And so I think there was just so much confusion about who they're supposed to be that,
you know, I think, and pilots will do that sometimes. And that's a tricky thing with them broadcasting it forth, is we've seen the characters establish and now we see them disestablish. Is that a thing? We suddenly see the characters at their, it's almost like it's almost like we're watching a show where like we're thrown into the middle. And then like at the end of season one, we get the origin story. And that's almost kind of what, here's the origin of it. But that's not quite what this is, because there was, I almost got the feeling watching some of it that like when they started making the show, someone on top, maybe Leonard Stern, said, you know what, that first episode really doesn't work. It's too long, and the characters never quite, one of my favorite moments in the episode, which is kind of shrugged off slightly, is the moment where after all this crap the husband pulls, after having their lives threatened and everything, Sydney is going to leave. Lonnie Anderson's, I'll just say Lonnie and Linda. Lonnie is going to leave with her bass. I think she's going to try out for like the symphony orchestra or something like that. If I remember correctly, that's what this scene is. And she's like, well, and Linda's like, well, when are you coming back? And Lonnie's, well, I'm not. Yeah. And I said, what? Well, you have to, because of this and this, and we have to do this and this. And Lonnie says something to her like, you know, I don't even know you.
Right.
And she's absolutely correct. They don't know each other at all. And it's a beautiful moment. But instead of it being a moment where Linda's like, you're right, you know, but we could get to know. Instead, Lonnie kind of backs away. And she's like, oh, no, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But the moment she says, it's a great moment, because this is what they're involved in is sort of nonsense, and she's being pulled into a lot. Both of them are being pulled into lives they don't want to be pulled into.
Right.
They don't want to become part of this again. And Lonnie is saying, "I've had enough. I'm leaving." Linda's trying to keep her there, and she says, "Why are you doing this? We don't know each other."
Yeah.
Why are you doing this? And it's a great dramatic moment, and it really works. But then they have her back away from it, which is a bit like,
Yeah, I love that scene, and you're right. I mean, they kind of pulled out of it in a weird way, but it was really a nice scene, and it said a lot about.
Yes.
It said a lot about their relationship, although it didn't quite get there.
Yeah.
So it was close though.
Yeah, because one of the things you will have in shows sometimes is sometimes you get the feeling with characters like this that they're sort of doing it right. They don't know each other. But then sometimes they'll get just a little too close, maybe a little too fast. Mm-hmm. And you're like, maybe that doesn't quite work. But just to have a moment where one of the characters basically says, we met yesterday. We don't know each other. We married the same guy, but our lives are not entwined. Mm-hmm. And we can stop that right now. Now, they don't stop it, obviously. There's a TV show based on them not stopping it. Right. But and that's actually, there are several moments in it that I really love. The My Wife thing I really like. A couple of the reveals here and there I really like. I do like the moment where she uses the flash on her camera to stop the guy from coming at her in the end.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
It captures someone stealing the bridge, which maybe is a coincidence too far, but it's still a cool moment where she's
right.
Like, I know who stole the bridge. How do you know? And then you're sitting there going, how does she know? And then all of a sudden you're in a room where everything's red and you're like, oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So there are some very good moments in it.
Mm-hmm.
Peppered in with a lot of moments where I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. I mean, I wouldn't.
Too many stops and starts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was and the sort of mystery with the bridge and everything is never terribly, I didn't think, terribly interesting.
I think in terms of, like, you've talked about how this is, you know, maybe a way to teach people how to do a mystery, like the whole idea of a MacGuffin is sort of
true. Yeah,
that's like what's carried through this. Like the mystery doesn't seem to matter.
It really doesn't after a time. Yeah,
yeah.
It's about setting the world up for the show. And
yeah.
You get that. You do get that a lot in pilots, right? You get that where like if there's a mystery or an alien invasion or something, it's a very like when Doctor Who returned in 2005 with the episode Rose, the Nestine consciousness attacks. They're a big thing. They're a big crazy thing in the Doctor universe. But the Doctor kind of takes care of them like that was a snap. I don't know if you could hear that. Takes care of them like that. And why does he do that? Because the episode's not about them really. It's about introducing Rose and introducing this world. So the same way with the bridge thing. But then that Doctor Who episode is only about 45 minutes long, and this is 96.
Right.
And I just really think if they had done it maybe as a 90-minute episode and it had been like 73 or 74 minutes, I think that would have been just a little more time than an hour-long episode, but not too much. We're an hour into it, I'm sitting thinking, wow, I could be elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the moments are what make it for me, too.
There's, yes.
There's first of all, that audition scene, I thought...
Yeah.
Was really like it was suddenly we were in a slasher movie, like
yes,
just like really,
yes.
You know, it was well shot and it was
it has
suspenseful.
A horror tinge to it that I like, yeah.
Yeah, and it happens again in the later scene with the toy expo with that like creepy doll that starts laughing and all that stuff. So like there were definitely moments. Linda tries to hide this note in her bra at one point. And Lonnie says, no, that's the first place he'll look. That was a great line.
Yeah.
So, and also, I just wanted to mention that there's a spectacular stairway stunt with John Shuck. Mm-hmm. When his character, you know, is pushed down the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I don't think it's him. You know, there's like stunt people.
Yeah.
You know, all four people in the scene are stunt people. But it's a great stunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to talk about John Shuck because I love him.
Yes, I'm a big fan also. Yeah, please.
Yeah, and I always, you know, like to mention when somebody's in MASH. He wasn't in the TV show MASH, but he was Painless in the movie. And also, I thought this was contemporary with the show, but it was actually much earlier. He did this show that may qualify for eventually Supertrain, called Holmes and Yo-Yo.
I think that might qualify, I believe. If we can find the episodes. If we can find the episodes, yeah.
Because I always remember him from that, even though it's like one of his lesser sort of projects.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess maybe I was watching TV when the promos happened, and I may have seen an episode or two, but... I just love the idea of him being like this robotic cop.
Yes, like Jaime from Get Smart, kind of, yeah, but a cop, yeah.
Yeah, so I love John Shuck.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, too. Because he was in MASH, he plays the kind of big dumb cop in Brewster McCloud. Mm-hmm. He's in Thieves Like Us. He's so good in Thieves Like Us with Shelley Duvall and one of the Carradines. I forget which one. But he's great in that. And he's and of course, a few years after this, he plays Herman in The Munsters Today, which right. may not be very good. In fact, I will say, it's funny, I actually own a set of The Munsters Today on DVD-R, sort of bootlegged, and every once in a while I'll watch it and I'll just shake my head at it. I'll just shake my head and go, what on earth? Why? It's really, because I love Judge, and he's fun in this. I mean, when you see, the moment you see him in this, you think Leonard Stern, you think McMillan and Wife. And right. you're hoping he'll have something like he did, like the cop he played in McMillan and Wife. But it's not quite, but it's always nice to see him. Uh-huh. In something, so
yeah.
But it's a so. What else do you have on this one? I'm going to scan my notes. Because I'll be honest, I've sort of said the things I really like, and I don't want to go too negative because yeah. I don't want to go now because I have a small list of things that I really didn't like. But I don't really want to go that route. So check your list. I'll check mine.
Yeah, Like I said, I have a lot of little moments that I just really loved. I Please. Love them changing a tire in their sparkly evening gowns. They have to change the tire on their car. And when Linda, like, bends down to help, like, literally, like, her entire gown just starts sparkling, like, it's almost special effects. Because it's so dark, I guess. But so I love that moment. You know, that's like one of those sort of juxtaposing moments that they're after, I think, in this series, where they're supposed to be these, I guess, you know, scruffy wannabe investigators, but they're these glamour pusses. What else? The guys in the bar buying them drinks, those poor guys with their 80s mustaches, they're never going to succeed.
Nope.
And in that, and this is maybe revealing more about me as a neophyte sort of videographer, but the shot of Linda in that bar, she's got a black background and she's got black hair, so they have to light her from behind to put sort of a glow behind her hair. So she's got this sort of halo around her, and it's a really nice shot, and it's... it's really done out of necessity, but I think it's really pretty. Yeah. So, you know, I love that shot. There's this moment at the beginning, and speaking of them sort of finding out who they are, it's the first night that they really are sort of thrown together. Linda is staying at Lonnie's apartment, and she doesn't have anything because her luggage was stolen. And Lonnie says, I'll get you one of my nightgowns. Although we're not built the same, you're... And then she struggles a little bit and she's like, you're taller? And when I first watched that, I didn't know what the hell she was trying to get at. Like, are you saying that Linda is not as shapely as you? Because she kind of is. like they're both... They're both shapely, beautiful women, and I don't really get what... I mean, seeing subsequent episodes, I think the idea is that Lonnie is supposed to be the more kind of vampy, yes. sexy, shapely one, even though, you know, Linda's just every bit as shapely as her, but she is sort of taller, and her character is more, I don't know, withdrawn or something, yes. more conservative. And so the idea seems to be that Linda's not as outrageously buxom or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's the way she, however it was she was raised, which is a little vague here and there.
Yeah, so I didn't really get the joke, but it was a very strange little moment. Mm-hmm. So it was as though this script was left over from when somebody else may have been cast in the show.
Yeah, maybe there's a thought. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It was weird, but yeah,
there is that moment near the end where they specifically have a moment where they have Linda put on like a shoulder, not shoulderless, strapless, like a strapless dress,
mm-hmm.
Almost like it's been like maybe someone like a producer said, Can we get Linda in something where she shows off a little something, please? Okay, we'll rig it. So, and they do this thing, and he just, you know, Shane brings in something that he thinks looks nice, which is completely inappropriate, this strapless evening gown for her to wear. She looks gorgeous in it. So now when they're doing these scenes, she's in this evening, and it's like, it's funny, and it's wonderfully odd to incongruous. But at the same time, when you see it, you sort of think, is that someone like in charge going, gosh, you know, Linda's been kind of wrapped up in, you know, just full dresses the entire time when Lonnie's been in the skirts and jeans and stuff. Maybe we need to think up something to put her in something.
Yeah.
You know, that shows off, this is Linda.
Yeah. So I do have a couple of other, like, sort of miscellaneous moments here. Mm-hmm. So Carol has been arrested. Linda Carter has been arrested. And there's this gang, I guess, behind her that she winds up like asking one of them to use their phone call for her. And yes, they just look like the typical sort of 80s white guy gang. Like, they're not really a gang. They're just a bunch of dudes.
It is a pile of crackers just hanging out in prison. Yeah.
And also, there's this bit that Sid has during dinner. She's having dinner with I forget his name, the guy who's like the rich guy who's going to wind up, you know, he's trying to buy the bridge.
Yeah.
And she keeps dropping her hanky, and it's kind of a funny bit. Mm-hmm. And the way it resolves itself is she's because she's trying to get him to bend over so she can put his. She's like a pickpocket, and so she's trying to put his wallet back in his jacket, and he will never get the hanky because other people keep picking it up for her, and so she finally just throws his wallet on the floor, and she's like, "You dropped your wallet.
Is that your wallet? Oh gosh, how'd that get there?" And then he picks it up, and I think like the same thing with the napkin. Oh, and your napkin. Oh,
and your napkin. So
that's,
right.
Yeah,
that's a nice tag on that.
Yeah.
And so I have a couple of I guess observations about some of the landmarks. There was, you know, there's this hotel they use, which I noticed that it was the same hotel from Celebrity, the first episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is there only one hotel in San Francisco? But apparently it's called the Mark Hopkins International, and it's in the credits, like, you know, I think they have a deal with them. Okay. Like, you know, they put up the guests for the show in that hotel film some scenes there. So they get a special deal there. So I think they promised to, like, you know, feature the hotel. Mm-hmm. And also, I didn't know anything about this, except I love chocolate, but the Girardelli, is it Girardelli Square?
Girardelli, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was featured in The Hottest Guy in Town, and then you also saw the big Girardelli sign in the Toy Expo. Like,
they were
replicating some kind of town square or something.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's big in San Francisco. I've never been to San Francisco, so
I have, but it's been some time. And I just wanted to go do like the bullet style chase and just go over like hills with cars real fast just so we can fly through the air. No one would do that with me. No one would do that with me. Like I said, I'm done talking about the episode because I've said what I thought was good and a few things I thought were a little off. I will say also one thing, I don't know whether I like it or not, I find it slightly amusing. Is there a point in the episode where everyone narrates it? Like, is there a point? It's like, it starts off with a mother-in-law, and then I think Linda Carter comes in, Lonnie Anderson's doing another moment. Or you know what? It's not only that, there were a couple of weird voiceover moments, like at the end of scenes where, like, they're getting in cars, and then all of a sudden they'll say something like, they'll be getting in the car, and like, well, thank you for helping me out. Yeah, you know where we got to go. We got to go to this place. Yeah. Let's go there now. Oh, goody. You know, and then they'll go, and it's almost like these weird, like, hey, does anyone know where they're going next? Let's throw some ADR in there. Let's throw something in. Because there were at least two moments where I was like, That dialogue is really kind of like tacked on to the very end of a scene, almost like they threw it in at the last second.
I noticed. Not
that that's bad. It's a pilot. There could have been, who knows? I mean, I bet you this might be like, I'd love to hear the story behind the pilot. If it was something where like they did it like it was the best thing we'd ever done, or it came back and it was like there were some issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly they got rid of the one character. I guess he was the assistant to the original guy that died, and then he went out and got Lonnie or Linda in New York. Yeah, he just totally disappeared. The mother-in-law starts the whole episode with this big old, you know, I don't know, Mike Hammer kind of narration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it just goes away.
Yeah.
You never see it again, and she's not even in the second episode or the first episode, the celebrity episode.
Yeah.
She's not even in that episode.
Yeah, it's interesting having. Do you have anything else on this? Because I think that's. I
literally have one more note, and that is when after the fuse goes out, which is kind of a funny bit because I don't know, it's just a rundown house, even though it looks gorgeous. And actually I have a side note about how that might be some kind of parallel to how glamorous Lonnie and Linda look and how inside they need work, but like I don't think the show is that deep, but
probably not. But if you we still have what 9 episodes left, so if you can support it, let's do it.
But one of the times when the fuse goes out, when the lights come back on, Sid is standing under a chandelier, and she gets an idea just as the light bulb literally lights up over her head. And I thought that was a nice little, I don't know, somebody thought that was clever. And I'm like, good for you, man. That was clever.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, yeah. it's an interesting episode. It's, I'm kind of glad that it aired fourth because, like I said, I think if it had aired first, I might have been a little iffy coming back. But at this point, I like the characters, and I know that it improves.
Yeah.
So now I've seen the origin story, and I consider this a flashback episode rather than an out-of-place episode.
Right.
So I'm going to call it a flashback just so we see how it all started, and now we can return to our regularly scheduled Partners in Crime.
Yes.
And I think... Yeah, that's all I have. If do you have anything? Any more notes?
I don't think I do. No.
All right. So let us as in me ask us as in you. One, what were you eating throughout this episode?
I was eating a hybrid homemade yet also frozen pizza from Red Baron.
Nice.
They are geniuses with crust and sauce.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's all you need to start with, and then you make your own toppings.
You do it on your own. Yeah. It's a beauty of a pizza. I saw him eating it, and I wish. Ask me about it. Maybe I'll sell you some of the footage. It was fantastic.
It's delightful.
So Stan, where can we find you online? What do you get up to? What do you do? What happens?
Well, first of all, my professional, and by professional I mean I don't make any money at all, podcast is WonderWomanWednesdays.com. I talk about the great Linda Carter and the classic Wonder Woman TV series, and I always talk with a Wonder Woman cosplayer, which I think adds a nice dimension to the discussion. And I also have a weekly live Facebook video with my buddy Jack on facebook.com/theRealGuys, and we talk about movies and drink beer.
And it's fantastic.
Max Headroom, Episode 9, Season 2, Episode 3, Grossberg's Return. Directed by Janet Greek, written by Steve Roberts. October 2nd, 1987. And again, I'm going to use the Wikipedia plot breakdown because I think it's a pretty good one. Here we go. Network 23's rival TV network, Network 66, develops a scam to get votes for the upcoming gubernatorial election in the Viewdoze system, a device that claims you can watch as you sleep. Former Network 23 CEO Ned Grossberg returns, where he turns Network 23's attention away by creating a false scandal concerning Network 66's own political representative, Harriet Garth. Through this false story, Grossberg takes over as the new CEO of Network 66 and is planning to rig the election to get 66's candidate into office. When this fails, Networks 23 and 66 are at war. Tim S. Turner and I are on the other side of this.
Max Headroom, Season 2, Episode 3, Overall, Episode 9, Grossberg's Return. And speaking of Grossberg, here's Tim S. Turner. Tim, how are you?
Hey, pretty good. I really like this one.
Oh, good. Well, and so did I. So, Tim, where can we find you online?
Already? Wow. Wow. I feel special.
Do it now. We always do it at the end. Do it now.
Well, you can find my co-host Agni Hogaboom and I on Beauty, the Beast, and the Bees discussing cult films and horror films, whatever the hell we feel like cramming into the format.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And next up, this brand new old show with a guest host that you love. And now let's talk about the episode. I think the fun thing now is it's like one of those episodes of Monty Python's Flying Circus where the closing credits would roll early in the show, so you never knew when the show was going to end.
Right.
The show would just end, and the only way you knew it was going to end was there'd be that copyright line at the bottom of the screen. Like, Monty Python Pictures Limited, 1970. That's when you knew it was all. So you don't know. We don't know when this is going to end, everyone. You don't know when it's going to end. Let's just talk for a little bit about Grossberg's Return. You said you liked the episode. Good God, why? No, I'm kidding. Why?
Well, first of all, I love Grossberg.
Sure, yeah.
And thankfully, he appears in several more episodes after this.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah.
I think it was kind of weird that they waited so long to bring him back. He's such a great villain.
Yeah.
He's just you can see whenever you see any scene with him, he's got the stress level cranked to 11.
Yes.
And he's got that one fidget thing that he does.
Yeah.
And he's filled with rage
constantly, you know,
and he suppresses most of the time. And the best part about it is like the entire episode is all about him getting revenge.
Yes.
On everybody at Network 23. Mm-hmm. And it's great because they put up what they do. They have a sequence where he's talking about who he wants to get.
Yeah.
And they'll show a picture of someone and then their name and what they do or whatever. And, you know, and he's like, you know, Edison Carter, he stopped me. And then, you know, Theora Jones, she was there, you know, Murray.
But no last
and
name.
Ben Cheviot, you know. Yeah. It's just Murray. There's no last name.
Yeah, no last name. Like Prince Murray.
It's cracked me up. But yeah, it's this. It's a really well written episode.
It's very clever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very clever. It's a little twisty turny. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you really, you know, get that Grossberg is a weasel and he's clearly trying to get rid of the head of Network 66 so he can take control. It's a lot of fun and it's got some great moments in it.
Yeah.
And I liked the little tag scene at the end.
Yes, that was fun. Yeah.
It was interesting. They were like at an outdoor garden party or something. And yet, of course, there's still little TVs there.
Yes.
So Max can be there. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's a there's brawl. Lots, it ends.
Yeah. There's lots of little great little, you know, I guess there's a kind of like some network, like almost Aaron Spelling kind of little rips. Like, I love the soap opera is Lifestyles of the Poor and Pitiful.
Yeah.
which is being challenged by Porky's Landing.
Oh, I love it.
What's her face? Lauren on the board says it's visual halitosis.
Yes, yes.
And then another great line that one guy, the guy with the mustache usually, uh-huh. but he's clean shaven in this season. He says, this is almost as bad as the ratings for Snow White and the Baby Eaters.
Yes, Snow White and the Baby. Yep. Yeah.
What the hell are they showing?
Yeah, it was great. The 66 there all night long. They're showing Porky's Landing, which basically you just see sort of just the same soap opera scene over and over again of like a man and a woman arguing about something. And I kept hoping it was going to break into like something Porky's style rather than just being something Knott's Landing. But I'm sure that comes later. That would have been later.
They did give it like a couple of kind of suggestive lines. Mm. Like, love is like an oil gusher.
Oh, yes, they did. Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's like the same man and woman on the same living room set, you know, having one of those, dynasty type fights. Mm. But I thought this episode, it was so much fun. There's so much going on. Yeah.
One of the things I really like about it, too, is that it starts off, you think that it's going to be about whatever that thing is that that they're doing, Viewdo. That's it.
Yeah, Viewdo. Yeah,
yes. So Channel 66 is doing a thing where, as Porky's Landing plays all night, it's basically a show that's meant to be watched while you're asleep, I guess. So it's playing all night, and they've got some thing which they themselves basically admit is a scam that takes down ratings as people are sleeping. Yeah. And so at 9 a.m., the whoever has the highest ratings, there's an automatic election, and whoever's candidate is matched up with the network that whichever one is the highest ratings, that candidate wins. And 66 begins to win because they have this thing, which is I love the fact that you hear about it, you think, oh, this sounds tricky. This sounds like something they may have based an entire episode around earlier.
Yeah, like but zigzag.
It's literally almost thrown away immediately because Grossberg has other ideas. This was just the thing to bring in 23 and to get them sort of paying attention, and now he's going to destroy them.
Yeah. Grossberg is great. He's kind of almost like a he reminds me like of a like a Spider-Man villain or something, he's got that kind of, he's gonna, shake his fist at the screen and
I will destroy you.
I want pictures of Spider-Man on my desk in the morning,
And it's because you have to think, like, when he's in a meeting there with the executives and the chairman, and he's like, yes, our Viewdo will work, and we will defeat this Channel 23's candidate, and then I will destroy Murray, and I will destroy – and you got to wonder, like, what are the other people are saying, oh, there he goes again. Or maybe, like, the first time they heard that, it would have been like, Grossberg, do you want to talk?
Do you need some tea, honey?
Do you like a little water or something? Because it is great, and the way he plays it and the way he's written, like they're having fun with it. It's like he's a little crazy, and I think he knows he's a little crazy, and everyone knows he's a little crazy. But he gets stuff done. He doesn't win this time. He almost does, because he keeps having an extra twist up his sleeve.
One of the things I do love about like Grossberg in this episode is he has got that kind of syndrome that surrounds a lot of villains in a lot of movies, where it's clear to anybody watching that he's up to no good. Yes. He's clearly evil, and he's going to do something to screw everybody else, right? Uh-huh. Because it's like the way his manner and the way he talks, nobody picks up on it.
No.
They're like, oh, clearly he's here to help Network 66. Yeah, even though he's sitting there and he's even doing like the five-fingered pyramid of death.
Yes.
You know, like, excellent suit. My plan will come to fruition. Oh, but I'm here to help.
He's the new marketing guy. He came up. Yeah, yeah, sure he is.
And the thing that's great, too, is that visual tick he had in the pilot. Where he, like, juts his chin out, he abbreviates it. It's not as exaggerated as it was before. Now it's just this very quick, like,
yeah, And I love that he is so in control of until the very end when he cut. If you look at the episode as being him really trying to take down 23, then he's failed. But if you look at this as he's trying to get a hold of 66, so he has so he has a platform from which to fight 23.
Right.
And he just so happens that the plan he's using might also affect 23, but it doesn't. But he's okay. If you look at it in that way, I love the way he's so in control. That when it gets near to the point when he's about to unchair the chairman, he just does that thing where, well, let me show you something. And he just leans over and almost casually like hits like 6 or 7 buttons on the computer.
Yeah.
And then something comes up. You're like, you didn't really hit anything, did you?
No.
you just hit some random.
Well, that's typical computer stuff in film. Yes. Where it's just here like tick, 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 tick. I'm in, you know, that kind of thing. I literally just got through like 8 firewalls with 3 keystrokes. One of the things he does that cracks me up in this episode is everybody's, you know, they've got that same boardroom kind of thing like Network 23 has, where they're all sitting at the long table with the chairman at the front, and everybody's always sitting. He keeps getting it standing up.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then like straightening his tie and his collar. And jut, you know.
and when you see this chairman compared to Chevrolet, you think he's actually our Network 23 guy is actually a pretty, a pretty decent guy.
Fairly benevolent. Yeah.
Yes. Compared to all the others, he's after the truth in the end, or trying to find the maneuvering his way through all the crap that Grossberg throws out at them, trying to get to the truth.
Yeah, at the end, he just kind of shrugs his shoulders like, well, I guess we didn't fool him all the time or whatever, you know. I did like the chairman, Chairman Thatcher, is played by Stephen Elliott, an actor I really like because, to punch the eventually super trained bingo card, he was on Columbo twice.
Yes.
he was killed by George Hamilton in Deadly State of Mind, and then
yes, that's right.
He was in the later incredibly awful episode Grand Deceptions with Robert Foxworth. And
that's
the funny
one of the
thing is
1990s ones. Or?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't seen that one. Okay.
Yeah, the funny thing is they're about 20 years apart, and he looks the same in both episodes.
Yeah, you got the bizarre John Carradine syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But And I think I mentioned in the previous episode that this one has like a lot of great villain actors, like character, like Sherman Howard and Andreas Kasulis, people whose names you might not know, but their faces you immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. It's overall when I was watching it, and as it's moving towards the ending and you keep getting another little twist and then you get another little moment and stuff like that, I was really, I thought, this is really nicely done. This is well done. I mean, this was still that point in like a lot of American television where, forgive me, things were kind of half-assed at this time. And just to see something like this where there's a clever twist and then there's another clever, and then they're over here and then they're over there and then they're doing this, and it keeps you going right up to the ending. And I got to say, I think we'll ruin the ending because the joy of the actual not the fight ending, but the actual election ending. I love that it's this was actually something when I used to write a lot of fiction. This is a sort of ending I would have done where it's a perfect ending that's also sort of beautifully anticlimactic at the same moment. Because the ending, and I'll ruin the ending here. So we get twist and turn, and this happened, and this happened, and da da da, and this happened, and so we're drawing close to the 9 a.m. time where whoever's got the highest ratings is going, their candidate will win. And 66 and 23 are neck and neck, and there are 3 other networks who are way behind. And basically, for like the past 3 or 4 hours, everyone watching 23 and 66 have been watching. 23 just reported 66 did this. Oh, 66 reported 23 lied. Oh no, 66 lied. Back and forth. And now we basically get a moment at like 1 minute till 9 where Edison's standing out front. He's going, I'm going to bring out The lady here, was it Harriet Garth, I think is her name? The candidate for Channel 66, who's been the middle of all this chaos. I'm going to bring her out, and we're going to tell you what finally happened. And then you cut to the board, you know, it's basically 9 o'clock right now, and you cut to the board showing the ratings, and all of a sudden the ratings for 23 and 66 both drop in the toilet, and one of the other networks shoots up, and their candidate wins. And yeah. I absolutely love that, because that's the ending isn't a big moment of, isn't a big, like, this happened, or it's the truth. It's just a moment where the viewers are like, oh, enough of this shit. And they just and they change the channel. And I kind of like, it's anticlimactic, but it's also perfect for the moment. Because you're like, oh, I didn't expect it at all.
I didn't either.
And the moment it happens, you're like, and you look at it and you go, wait a minute, what just happened? And then you realize it's everyone watching getting so sick of all the BS back and forth between these two networks that they're just going to someone else. We're just going to give someone else a try. Now, in America, if you give someone who isn't one of the major, you know, people in the elections a try, you're wasting your vote, basically. In this, however, it worked, and everyone went that route.
Yeah.
I like that. It's a twisty, turny episode with a great mustache twirling, but he doesn't have a mustache villain. And you get a lot of good stuff with Edison and Theora and Murray trying to figure out what's going on. And Max shows up occasionally saying stuff and doing stuff. And you get a lot of chicanery and twists and, you know, well, we prove this. Oh, this is wrong and it's this. No, it's this. And I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. And I'm glad that Grossberg is back, because he gives sort of a nice perfect kind of villain, I think, for this sort of thing, because he's sort of tech-savvy, and he's there, and he's apparently got a lot of money, and now he's got an entire network behind him where he can fight our heroes.
Yeah, so, yeah. I really wish that, like, they had brought him back a lot sooner.
Yeah.
Because even if it was...
finale of the first season or something, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even if it was just, like, an occasional cameo by him show up, you know, like one someday Edison,
yes.
You know, or something. I think that's one thing that I think the show needed, and I think he brings that boost back as a perennial villain.
Yes.
To challenge Network 23. I think there's one thing that we haven't talked about, and that is that we see Edison get jealous.
Yes.
Of Theora, because he calls her on his little video phone, and you see some guy's arm wrapped around her in bed, and he gets real pissy about it.
Yes, he does.
And then later on, they're talking about it. She's talking to Murray, and she's like, you know, he's not really my type or something like that, but you are. And she looks at Murray, and he's like, whoa, huh?
Yeah, Murray does exactly the face I would have done.
Yeah, and so, then Max is like, she met me. He's like, no,
yes,
she met
that's
me. You know, back and forth. But I thought that was kind of an interesting thing that they could have explored, would be like a triangle.
Yeah, yeah, because in the previous episode, they had a moment where they, like, Theora kind of gave Murray a look, and Murray for a second was sort of like, did she just really do that? Did that just happen?
Yeah.
Kind of thing, but then they go, something else happens. But yeah, it happens here, and there's this sort of the intimation that Theora might be attracted to Murray, and of course, hey now, who wouldn't, right? So that's our Murray, right? You know, and Murray, he
just
doesn't have
Murray.
Just Murray, yeah, and he doesn't have sort of the arrogance or the cynicism, the full on cynicism of Edison. He's just a guy out there doing his job and, you know, losing his hair and growing his mustache out. And, you know, looking good doing it. That's our Murray. But yeah, that's kind of, I like it that at the end of the episode, all this, you get this really nice story, this really nice twisty turny plot that, like I said, to me, and I know, I hope you've watched it because we ruined it, but like, I had no idea what was going to happen. And it just keeps leading you further along, closer and closer to the ending. And it just keeps having one more twist up its sleeve. Until I love that, until the point where, I mean, you could almost say this is like, if this was like a, you know, like a movie, or like in a few years on when Twin Peaks is on,
yeah,
and they say, you know, it's starting to lose ratings because they clearly weren't going to say who killed Laura Palmer. You know, that's almost the same sort of thing, right? Like, it's a show with twists and turns, up its sleeve, and it never quite reveals fully what's going on, and eventually everyone tunes out and they go to watch Perfect Strangers and Family Matters. But I like that, that the concept being that there are just networks that are just throwing out so much sort of nonsense and sort of crap at the people that they just give up one day and go somewhere else, and hopefully that's decent. And I like that, and so you have that, the very good plot mixed with the return of a great villain mixed with a possible love triangle, something going on. So this episode ends, there is so much potential for, and what's her name reappears, Angie. Right?
Yes, Angie Barry, yeah. She gets more to do in this one.
She takes on the sort of the reporter role when Edison is reticent because they haven't fully looked at the clips. I do love Chevrolet in this because he's like, well, we have to do something. And then the clips show up and he's like, we got the clips. Go over there and talk to her. Then 5 minutes after they talk to her, what's going on? Those clips are fake. And it's just, yeah. It's just like, you were the one who said that, you know that, right? It's just like pure, like, I'm in charge, and just like I'm either conveniently forgetting what I just said, or I don't realize what I'm doing, or something. But but when you get to the end of the episode, there's such a feeling of now we've got there's a evil villain who's after you, who's in a great position of power, and now you know you've got the love triangle, and now you've got all this stuff, all this lies ahead of us here, and of course we only have 5 episodes left, but that doesn't mean a lot can't happen in 5 episodes.
Yeah, and I think Grossberg's in 3 of the 5.
Oh, good.
So, yeah.
There you go. So, what else do you have on this? I mean, I could talk about the plot more, but I'm not going to. Just watch it. Watch it.
Well, I did like at the very end in that garden scene, the garden party scene, you see Murray, and he's getting into an argument with this guy, and they cut over to Edison and Theora, and you hear this, commotion. Now, I thought what we were going to see is we're going to cut over to him decking the guy. No. We cut over. He's strangling him, genuinely throttling the guy until his face is blue. And I love that whole fight scene at the end. And then, Theora gets in there and decks a guy, and then they just go back to eating their lunch.
Yes. Yeah. And I love the moment when you very specifically see Edison and Murray just dumping a guy over the wall or whatever.
Yeah.
I like it just happens and now it's done. And I think that one guy who grabbed Theora, even I was like, hey man, no. Come on.
Yeah, no.
But she decks him pretty good. She gets a pretty good one in there. So yeah, overall, I mean, this is I think 2 great episodes in a row. Now, you've seen the remaining 5. I ain't seen diddly do, so I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm hoping they can keep them at least, if not at this level, near this level. Fingers crossed. You don't have to say anything. You want to say something? He's not going to say anything anyway. He's not going to say anything. Do you have anything else on this one?
No, not really. More Grossberg, please.
Yes.
I think the one time in the episode where he loses his cool is when the chairman says, "You worked for Cheviot, right?" And he's like, "On the contrary, he worked for me."
Yes.
And then he stops and readjusts his tie and everything. Yes. Goes, oh, sorry.
All right. All right. So that's Grossberg's return, everyone. Do we know what the next episode is? We don't have to.
I believe that the next episode is called Dream Thieves, and it's directed by the great Todd Holland.
our brand new old show, everybody. First episode of a brand new old show. We are going back to the 1970s. Yowza. And I'm here with someone you like, I like. Here she is, Kristen Hawes, a.k.a. Kiki Wright. How are you?
I am so happy to be back, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Would you tell everyone what show we are talking about?
We are talking about Chopper One.
Yay! Like I said, back to the 70s, and I'm going to read the back of the DVD box. It's not a box, it's two DVDs, the back of the DVD. Created and produced by Ronald Austin and James David Buchanan, Chopper One is a fast-paced action series set over the skies of Los Angeles. Don, Jim McMullen, downhill racer, and Gil, Dirk Benedict, TV's The A-Team, fly over the City of Angels, going places no police car can go. The two chase down drug dealers, kidnappers, and underworld crime figures, eluding danger on the ground and in the air. Catch all 13 episodes of this exciting series, executive produced by Aaron Spelling, TV's The Love Boat, and Leonard Goldberg's TV's Fantasy. I put too many S's in there. Leonard Goldberg, TV's Fantasy Island. So that's what the show is, everybody. It's from where I'm sort of looking at it, it's basically like Adam 12 in a helicopter. I think is the way I would describe it.
That's how I would describe it.
Kristen, had you seen the show before? Any history with it?
I had not. I was only familiar with the show in name only.
Same here. I think I'd seen it in Harry and Wally or whatever that book is, the TV show review book that I love that I had sitting right next to me so I could read the title and now it's missing. You know the book I'm talking about. I think it's Harry and Wally's favorite TV shows or something. They don't like it. But that's okay. Sometimes we disagree. But yeah, you brought it up a few months ago. You said, "Hey, let's talk about Chopper One." And I said, "You're damn right." I thought it was a show from the 80s because I thought like Blue Thunder, but it's actually 1974, around the time when I think Adam 12 was ending, I believe. But other Jack Webb type shows like Jack Webb shows like Emergency was still kicking, Heck Ramsey was starting, a few years to Project UFO, things like that. The first episode on the DVD, it's Chopper One. But everywhere else I've seen, it's just called Pilot because it's the pilot episode. But isn't that great though? Come on. It's Pilot. It's a chopper. It's Pilot. Get it? Right? Right? Come on. It's like the Doctor Who episode, the pilot that starts off series 10. It's about a pilot, but it's also called the pilot because you can start watching the show from that point. So it's like, get out of here. You know what I'm talking about. So and this basically, I've only seen this episode, but it starts off with a little pre-credits rescue where the two guys, it's Burdick and Dirk Benedict's last name is?
Foley.
Foley. Why did I think it was Kovacs? I got to write down Foley.
I don't know.
where the hell did I get Kovacs from? Foley. Oh, this pen's dead. So I'm going to call him Kovacs. Foley and Burdick rescue a kid who's gone sailing off of the coast in Los Angeles, and they rescue him before the credits, and then the bulk of the episode is just basically sort of drug dealers steal... have a fight with the guy at the Sheraton West in Los Angeles, kidnap the guy's wife, and it's up to our two chopper guys to stop them before they can escape with drugs and money and the hostage. So that's the basic of the episode. And what did you think of this one, Chopper One, a.k.a. Pilot?
I quite liked this episode. I thought it was a great way to kick off the series because it answers a very important question, I think, for me. And that was, this is kind of like Adam 12 in the Sky, but how much can you do with a helicopter? Because I'm thinking police helicopter, you're limited to just following cars and that sort of thing. I was not anticipating an ocean rescue to kick things off and then having it utilized in a hostage situation. Mm-hmm. So, this is kind of a high, exciting way to kick off a series,
I thought. I agree. It's like it's very much like the first episode of Adam 12, except Adam 12 has that element in the first episode of the rookie cop meeting Marty Milner, who just got off the road from Route 66 after having been traveling for so long. But that has this, and the fun thing about Chopper One is that when it starts off, Foley and Burdick are. I mean, there's an implication at one point that like Foley is well, he's clearly younger than Burdick, and there's a point where Foley says something like, "You were born to be a you act just like a cop," and Burdick says, "Well, maybe one day you will too," and they all laugh about it and freeze frames. No, I'm kidding. There's no freeze frame, but there's an implication that Foley, the pilot, is younger than Burdick, who's the guy who jumps out of the plane when they need to. But they don't have that sort of rookie we're just meeting kind of thing, which I kind of like because it begins with them. It doesn't say how long they've been traveling together on the chopper. They're just, that's their thing. They're the chopper guys. And it just kicks right in. There's very little character development. They're just brave guys who try to save the day. And I like Adam 12, more or less. And I think it works well, because my thought was the same thing. What are we going to do with choppers? Because the thing I remember about Blue Thunder, the movie, is that the plane was cool, but I don't remember the movie being that cool. All I remember is them looking at naked ladies. That's really all I remember. Now, granted, I saw it when I was 12. But that's really all I remember. So I had that exact same thought, was sort of, what can we do with helicopters apart from maybe chase other helicopters? But they do a nice job here. It opens up with the rescue out on the water, and then there's a really nicely done chase in the end where they have to stop a small plane from taking off, and they make it clear as they're flying towards the plane that they have maneuverability, but the small plane has speed. So if the plane takes off, it's gone. They're not going to catch these drug dealers and save the hostage. So Foley just does this great thing where every time the plane is getting up speed, he just flies the copter in front of it. So it has to kind of take a sharp turn, and its velocity drops, and it has to build it up again. It's really some rather dangerous-looking moments with the small plane and the helicopter, which I didn't expect that. It's always nice to... You know, like you say, I came away from it thinking, okay, so we can do stuff with the choppers. I was just thinking it would be like, put someone in a chopper, drop them off somewhere, chase another chopper. That was my thought, but it's not. There's more. Let's dive in a little bit more. These are half-hour episodes, and the thing I found interesting about this one is that when it's a little over 25 minutes, I think 25 and a half minutes. And the opening sequence where they rescue the kid and the opening credits take about 6.5 minutes. So the actual like bulk of the episode minus like a minute of credits is like 18, 19 minutes. And I kind of like that. There's not a lot of goofing around. It's just stuff happens and then the episode ends. Like the Green Hornet, which we covered so long ago.
They get a lot done in a short amount of time.
Yes, they really do. They really do. And you meet their captain or whoever who's constantly yelling at them in classic captain style. And you meet some of the older cops. Yes, one of them is named Lou. You kind of get a little taste of everything you need to get outside of the chopper action, but it's mostly chopper action, which is cool. And the funny thing is, that's one of the things I love about Adam 12 and Dragnet is that obviously this isn't made by Jack Webb. This is Aaron Spelling's take on it. Although I can't really see much in here that made me go, "Oh, that's a Spelling moment right there," or something. I'm trying to think if there was really anything. Maybe in later episodes, but not really in this one. This one feels very sort of Spelling doing the Jack Webb kind of thing.
You know, I do want to point out that I love the theme song. The theme song rocks.
Yeah, it's a good theme song.
That's important for a 70s cop show, is to have a kick-ass theme song. And and they nailed it, I feel.
Yeah, because you're going to it's not like today's where you get maybe 10, 20, 30 seconds. Here you get, I mean, the opening credits are over a minute long. So you got to kind of sink in and get the theme. And you want the theme like kicking around in your head. So when it starts off, you're like, yeah, you got it going. And they do a nice job with it. Yeah, it is a good – it is a sweet theme.
I do want to say that because you point out there's not a whole lot of character development, but you do get – in that short amount of time, you get the basic personalities of Burdick and Foley really quickly, in that Burdick is – you know, obviously he's the vet. He's been doing it longer. He's kind of got the drier humor, mm-hmm. and he's a little more, I don't want to say serious, but he's mature, I guess, yes. is what I would mm-hmm. say. But Foley is, he's got that youthful exuberance. He's a little more of a smartass.
Yes.
And he has drunk neighbors, apparently.
Oh, that, yes, that's right, yeah.
They keep him up, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, it's one of those shows I think well like the way Adam 12 would do it or a lot of the shows back then did it where you're not going to there's no moment during the episode where like one of them like can't do something and the other one says is it because of the incident from last year and then all of a sudden you get a flashback to something. And you're like, what was that? And, you know, 40 episodes later, we find out what that was. We don't get anything like that here, which is actually a relief. It's a relief to just get two guys who are doing their jobs. They clearly do it well. I mean, Foley is an excellent pilot. And there's always that thing, too, I love with helicopters, where there's one point where the mechanic is talking to them. And he says, like, you got enough gas for 2 hours and 50 minutes. Oh, yeah, we'll be fine. Well, yeah, you'll be fine until you drop 1,000 feet out of the air like a stone. and I think on a recent episode or something I did recently. The commentary I did with Rob Kelly for The Swiss Conspiracy. In the end of that, there's a scene where David Janssen shoots like a helicopter out of the sky. And you just think, watching movies sometimes, you think helicopters seem to me the most delicate. They're like little ballerinas of the sky or something. They're just the little delicate things. I get so scared. But in this, the helicopter does a lot of work, and it seems to be pretty hefty. I feel okay in this helicopter.
Yeah, it feels pretty slow. Well, you know what? I think it's because of Mitch, the mechanic. He seems like he keeps things running pretty well. I have a feeling I'm going to really like him.
I thought when I saw him, I was going to write a little note. I think Kristen's favorite character just had a brief scene.
It's true.
And, you know, the disappointing thing will be, since we only have 13 episodes of this, we're not going to get an episode where he joins them. I would bet we don't get one where he joins them in the cab or something like that. Where he gets
to, hop in. Oh, yeah. That would have been great. Well, you know, we'll see.
Maybe we do. Maybe we do. Yeah. But, let's see. They rescue the kid. And when they rescue the kid, they fly over a bunch of L.A. I recognize some of the buildings. And I think... Like the moment it's like there's a kid and they go let's go and you see them flying over buildings and stuff mainly buildings. There's some stuff there, but it's mostly buildings they're flying over. And I believe that's in the Westwood area, which is Wilshire Boulevard. I used to work there, and it's like Westwood is, it's a very nice area. And you sort of have Westwood, and then you go a little bit more west, and you get like Brentwood and Santa Monica. You go a little bit more west, and it's the ocean. So Westwood is not quite at the ocean, but when they say they can get there quickly, they can get there quickly. And then also the Sheraton West is also, I believe, used to be on Wilshire. It was the Sheraton Townhouse, I believe. And then it became the Sheraton West, and it's near Lafayette Park, sort of in downtown L.A., near not too far-ish from Hollywood. And very, very kind of, if you're taking a bus, and I have many times down that road, it's a very far distance from, like, the Sheraton West to the Westwood area I was just talking about. But they're all there on L.A., and it's fun to see the Sheraton West because it's not there. Well, there's a building there, but that the big old letters, the Sheraton West on top of it, fun stuff, isn't there anymore. So, and Lafayette Park is still there right next to it. But it was fun to see the 70s... locations and one of the great things here is that with the show right now is that Stan and myself are talking about Partners in Crime, and Partners in Crime is all these great 80s San Francisco locations, so we're getting a lot of fun California locations in these shows. So
yeah When I was watching this episode, I was like, I know they have to film this in L.A., and if you weren't going to, I was going to make you point out everything that you recognized. Yeah. I'm like, Dan will know where this is.
Yes, yes. There's one building in particular, one kind of I think like right after they say, okay, you know, we're heading to the ocean, and you see them sort of flying sort of towards us, and behind it there's a big kind of brown brick building that's kind of weirdly with weird balconies and little bushes and shrubs on the side of it kind of thing. I believe that's right around in Wilshire. If it's not, I could see that building in my mind, when I immediately thought it, I thought, oh, that's in Westwood. I know that building. That's a fun building. But yeah, that's all sort of in and around the Westwood area, I believe. And then though, like I said, in the Hollywood, Los Angeles, down almost not quite downtown. Los Angeles is a tricky place to describe, so I don't even know what I'm talking about half the time when I say this. And I've been here 25 years, driving from, like, if you were to drive, hop in your car and drive from where the Sheraton West was to the ocean, if there was no traffic, it would be a minimum of like a half an hour, no traffic and no lights. But usually there's a lot of traffic, and because you go Los Angeles, and then you pass through sort of Hollywood, then you pass through Beverly Hills, then you pass through Century City, Westwood, Brentwood, Santa Monica, then you go into the ocean. So they're flying all over the place here, and it's fun to see. Some of it I recognized immediately. Some of it I was like, oh, I'm not sure. But it was great to see, and especially those big wide shots of them flying over everything. I was like, that's awesome. That's a lot of fun.
And it looks like, because I wondered, because this has to be expensive as hell to be using this helicopter as much as they are.
Yeah.
And I wondered if they wouldn't do it like most of the interior shots would be obviously not flying.
Yeah.
It would, you know, look like they're flying, but they're not. But they actually have shots where it looks like Dirk Benedict is flying the helicopter. I don't think he actually was, but it looks like he was. And you can actually see the scenery go past.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was unexpected.
Yeah, I was surprised that too, because I figured it would just sort of be kind of slightly lame process shots where it's like, oh, they're in the studio. But there are a few shots like there's a great shot of the Burdick character, like when they're approaching the Sheraton West, and it cuts from Dirk Benedict to Burdick character, and Burdick's kind of looking out the window of the chopper, and you can just see they're flying right by the huge Sheraton West letters, and it's really a lot of fun. The episode moves really quick, and one of the things, what did you think about the drug dealers and what they got up to? I mean, apart from being jerks,
that was kind of a fun hostage situation. Hostage situations be fun, because first of all, you didn't anticipate that Burdick was going to get out of the helicopter and go into the building. He jumps off, which I feel like Gil Foley could have gotten a little bit closer for him to dismount onto the roof. He was dropping like 8 feet. Like, you couldn't hover a little closer? Because he got back in fine.
Yeah. Not only was he a bit far away, but it seemed like he was doing a bit too much, like a bit too close to the edge
of
it. You know, he's like, just lower it 4 feet and move over six. Could you please?
I mean, you can do this. You're supposed to be this good, right?
Yes, yeah.
So, and he goes in to check things out, and he finds the drug, what we find out later is a drug dealer. He knows, because he looks around the room and goes, yeah, something's not right here. Mm-hmm. But the dude's been shot. Now, if you have at all listened to my podcast,
Book of Dan, you should have.
Yes. You'll know how much I love 70s blood, fake blood, because it looks just like it's nail polish or something. Well, this looks like he was been shot in the leg, but it looks like he just like spilled ketchup down his thigh.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. And
like, maybe the makeup guy hadn't shown up or whatever. They just
it's just like, I was eating a burger, it got out of hand.
And they took my wife.
Yeah, and they took my wife, by the way.
I noticed the burger's gone. Well, I was hungry.
Yes. Well, I had to, you know,
get nervous eating. Nervous.
But yeah, so they relayed the information that they have this hostage, and so I want to know why. Whenever we have situations like this, we have hostage situations, and the cops are like, what do you want? And then the people are like wanting the most extreme excessive demands. Yeah. I want, okay, all the cops out of here. I want a cop car with a working radio so I can, you know, monitor everything. And I want a plane waiting for me, and I want it in 5 minutes. Well, just chuck that woman out the window, because I'm not Santa. I'm not going to be able to get this for you in 5 minutes.
I'll get the elves on it. It'll be ready to go. Check your chimney. The fun thing with this episode that I like is the little trick, and I knew it was happening before. Actually, I think Burdick or Foley says it right when I said it out loud, and that's they're following the cop cars that's going down the freeway, and I paused and I said, well, I was the only one in the room, so who knows? I hadn't spoken for a minute, so I don't know if it was a real pause. Do you ever do that? Like I paused and then I spoke, but I was the only one there and I hadn't said anything in 5 minutes, so it was one long pause, a 5 minute pause.
Excessive pause.
Yes. So, but as they're driving and the chopper's following them, I said out loud, and I think one of them said it a moment later, they're not going to the airport. Because if the two big airports in L.A. are LAX and Burbank, and to get to the Burbank's literally in the center of Burbank, it's not a city, and LAX things don't get less busy. They get more and more busy, and so they're like out in the, there is somewhere way out there in the middle of nowhere, there is another airport, but it's quite some distance away from here. It's one of those that nobody ever really goes to because it's so far away, but even I knew they weren't going there, so it was fun, just because I was I'm sure other people probably watch it too and said, are they going to the airport? But that's what I said, they ain't going to the airport. They weren't, and it was fun that they gave out they had little tricks up their sleeves, which is why these were fun drug dealers. Yes. Yeah, little tricks here and there. And I do like that Burdick pretty much from moment one is like, okay, something's up right away. You know, he's okay, the thing with the guy in the room wasn't right. The way they put the hostage in there wasn't right. They're not going to the airport. He's pretty good.
Yeah.
He's pretty good.
He's good. Well, he thinks like a cop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Maybe one day you will too.
Well, you already do, Dan. You knew they weren't going to the airport.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because it, like I said, it's a 25 and a half minute episode. But once you take like it's only like 18 minutes and change once you take away the opening and the credits, and it moves very quickly. And I don't know that there's actually a lot to say about it. It's a fun, fast-paced episode. It basically gives you a very sort of basic setup. In the end, drug deal gone wrong, although we don't know that until the end. But it's basically drug deal gone wrong, someone's taken a hostage, and our guys in the helicopter have to stop them. And it's done very efficiently. It's done very swiftly. I think Jack Webb would have been proud if he saw this. I think it feels very Jack Webby. And I'm a fan, by the way, of Jack Webb's shows. I don't, you know, I'm a big fan of Adam 12, and the radio version of Dragnet is one of my favorite radio things ever. I'm trying to think of more to say about the episode, but apart from, it's
a very exciting opening to the series, but it also tells you exactly what to expect. You're going to get the opening, whatever, the, you know, the little taste, I guess, the little rescue or the little crime, the whatever, then you'll have the main story, and you'll have a happy ending, and you're going to have some hot helicopter action, because that playing chicken with the airplane scene was pretty awesome, really.
Damn good, yeah.
Again, that's not something I expected. I did not expect that they would have like that level of helicopter stunting happening.
Yes, I didn't either. Because as they're flying towards the plane, and like I said, where Foley says if that plane takes off, we'll never catch him. And I thought, well, what are you going to do? And then the moment he starts flying the plane and making flying the copter and making the plane have to bank and turn, and it keeps slowing down, I was like, oh, that's fantastic. I hadn't thought of that. Well, that's a great thing, right? Like, I didn't write this. If I had written this, I would hope I would have thought of that. Like, if you and I, if this was created and produced by Kristen Hawes, Dan Budnick, Chopper One, I would hope we would have thought the same thing.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope we would have been that creative.
So what else? Do you have anything else on this one? It's got a nice little. We won't say what happens in the end. We don't really need to, I think. But there is a bit of a twist-a-roo in the end, which I don't think is a huge twist, because I think Burdick figures out what's going on early on, and I think it's one of those things where it's okay that we do too. It's not something I don't think because there's a moment right at the end with sort of the classic I'm gonna kill the hostage, I'm gonna count to three. There's one of those classic moments, and he does something there where like you're like, what's happening? And for a split second you're like, what's going on? And then it's resolved and you're like, oh, okay, bravo.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, the little twist at the end, that was actually really. Really good ending. I like the way it ended.
It was nicely done, and I like too the sort of reveal of it. We won't say what it is, but it's really nicely done. Like if I recommend it, I don't know. I recommend it highly. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do too. It is a lot of fun.
Do you have anything else? I wrote down here just one word: sandwiches. But I don't know. When did they eat sandwiches? Oh, gosh. Oh, no, that's right. They were talking when they go to visit Lou and I forget who the other cop was, the older cops, and they kind of say, well, you guys up there in your chopper, you got the life, but you miss all the great donuts and all the coffee and donuts. Well, maybe you're having too many, Lou. And he pats him on the tummy. I don't think it was Lou he patted on the tummy.
Yes, that jovial locker room talk.
Yes. There's an interesting one interesting thing where I thought for a second it was going to be more you know, because Adam 12s usually have like two or three different things going on,
yeah,
sort of kind of intermingled and stopping and starting, but this is very specifically one thing, credits, another thing, closing. And but there is a point where and I just wrote down, I don't know why I did this, I just wrote down letters here, but it's their boss says something to them like, hey, I want you to monitor the North Shore NS, I have NS high school football game, something to do with maybe drugs or something, I forget.
I think he said something about gang activity.
Yes, that's right. So that was interesting there, because they say, you know, you're gonna go out on your shift for the 2 hours and 50 minutes, and we want you to monitor this high school football game for gang activity. So you sort of think for a split second, oh, that's what it's going to be about, and then nope, not at all. Maybe in a later episode that'll come up, but I kind of like that. It sort of implants in your mind that, you know, the thing they're about to do, which, technically, right, so they, once they take off from, once they leave the mechanic until the end of the episode, it's all less than 3 hours, because they never go to refuel. So it all takes place in, like, less than 2 hours and 50 minutes, because there's never so I kind of like that. So the bulk of the episode takes place in probably about 3 hours, which is cool.
Yeah. That is cool.
Yeah. So do you have anything else on this? I kind of really don't. I wish I did. Oh, I did one thing. 459 report. Foley is asked if he had filled out his 459.
Yes, and he didn't, because of his drunk neighbors keeping him up.
Because of his drunk neighbors keeping him up. A 459 is an illegal entry into a residence with the intent of committing a felony, usually burglary. So they don't say specifically what it is, but that's what a 459 is. That was a big thing with Jack Webb stuff, is he would, like, Dragnet, especially the early Dragnet on the radio, they would say all this stuff. They would say, okay, we got a 234 and a 418 down on the 212. Go on down there now, you guys, 10-4. And people would write it, and Jack Webb would actually, at the end of episodes, say, you say a lot of stuff in the episodes, you don't explain what they mean. Could you please? And so he would, like, there was one episode where he would, like, he went through, like, a list of things. And he was like, well, this means that. And when we say this, it means that. Which I appreciated. But I like the 459. They don't tell you what a 459 is. I would have liked to have seen how the chopper did that. Like, following a burglar around the house, did it go around the house? Or what did it do? But I don't know.
I'm guessing he spotlighted him.
Yeah. So if you don't have anything else on this one, I think I'm good.
I just have a little bit of trivia.
Yes, please.
On this. So our two leads, Jim McMullen and Dirk Benedict. They would go on to work together later because Jim McMullen showed up on an episode of the A-Team. And Dirk Benedict and Lou Frizzle, who played Mitch, they worked together before the show. They were on an episode of Hawaii Five-O, and
no way.
Lou Frizzle, I'm not sure how to say his name, beat the crap out of Dirk Benedict's character on that episode.
Oh, gosh.
So I'm glad to see they're on happier terms in this show. Also, so one of the gunmen, the first gunman, who didn't get a name, was played by an actor and stuntman named Ronnie Rondell Jr. He was actually the father of Reed Rondell, who played the boy in the boat that was rescued.
Oh, wow.
At the beginning, and he would go on to be a actor and stuntman. Sadly, he passed away at a young age in a helicopter accident on the set of Airwolf.
Oh, my. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I hate to be a downer, but I just had to point out that here he was in this show about a chopper, and
yes,
he unfortunately passed away in the show about a chopper.
Oh, that's too bad. Airwolf, a show I've never seen.
You've maybe never I seen will Airwolf? One
day. I've never seen. Maybe when we get to the end of Chopper 1, we'll do a special episode where we'll watch a random episode of Airwolf and talk about it.
Yes, I haven't watched Airwolf in years, but I'm stunned that you have not.
I don't think I've seen Airwolf, yeah. I have told you, like, during that time period, I had trouble watching hour-long shows.
Yes, but Airwolf was an hour of Ernest Borgnine every week.
Oh, my God. If I could travel back in time, one of the first things I'd do is tell my younger self to watch Airwolf, knowing how much I love Borgnine.
It's worth it.
So, do you have any more trivia?
No, that's it.
Okay. The last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to ask you where we can find you online, is I do like the moment the guys have their final chat, and they have their final chat sort of underneath the small plane as they find the drugs. And, you know, you think like a cop, maybe you will someday. And there's a great helicopter shot of them coming out from behind the plane, and the helicopter, it begins to sort of go up in the air and go up in the air. And the first thought you have is, oh, they're in the helicopter. They're using that. But it's actually another helicopter because you can see their helicopter on the ground. So they've got a second helicopter. Well, they would have, right? That shoots the helicopter in the shot. So this would be, I don't know. But it's kind of fun to watch because it suddenly pulls up, and the last shot in Chopper 1 is a helicopter shot of the guys on the ground. And there's a great moment as they're walking to their helicopter and you see the cops pulling up, you just see like the three crooks like handcuffed just sitting there. Just kind of like, is this over? Can we go? Can we go? It's a little awkward looking, but also kind of fun because you're like, it's like we caught you, and it's like, okay, sit right here. The cops are going to be here. We're going to see what you got in your plane. They go over to the plane. They check it out. They're like, let's get out of here. And as they're walking back to the helicopter, they look over, and they're like, they'll be right here. Here they come. Sorry. Little awkward. But they're right there. Sorry. I thought they were going quicker. I thought you'd be talking to them. I don't have anything to say to you. But it's just like a weird, you know, just one of those moments. Like once you catch them and tell them someone else will take care of you, you don't want to have to encounter them again before that person has shown up. You know, awkward cop moments, cop and criminal awkward moments. Wasn't there a show on True TV called like Awkward Cop and Criminal Moments? Or maybe I'm making that up. But
I think you're making that up.
Yeah. So let's wrap this one up with. Where can we find you online?
You can find me at akakikiwrites.com. That is the home of my podcast, Book'em Dano, an old Hawaii Five-O podcast. Hey. You can find me on my blog, kikiwritesabout.com. And if you want my chopper thoughts in real time and you can't find me on the hell site formerly known as Twitter, you can find me on Blue Sky at Kiki Writes.
All right. And, yeah, that's the end of this episode, everyone. So we'll be back in a couple weeks with the next episodes. Some more Chopper 1, some more Max Headroom, and some more Partisan Crime. Be good to yourself, everyone. Here we go.